three men were sitting together bragging about how they'd given their new wives duties. And first man from the Midwest, Indiana, bragged that he had told his wife she could do all the dishes and house cleaning and they had to be done before he got home. And he says, it took about 3 days, but on the third day I came home to a clean house. All the dishes were washed and put away. Second man married a woman from Utah, and he bragged that his wife, he ordered her to do not just the cleaning and the dishes, but all the cooking, and she better have a great meal on the table every day when he came home. And he says he didn't see anything at first, but by the third day, you know, she had it all figured out. The house was clean, the dishes were done, huge dinner on the table. Third man married a Jersey girl. He told her that her duties were to not only keep the house and the dishes washed, but mow the lawn, do the laundry, and put the hot meals on the table for every meal. And he said the same thing. The first day he didn't see anything. Second day he didn't see anything. By the third day, most of the swelling had gone down and he could see a little out of his left eye. Just enough for him to get a bite to eat and load the dishwasher and telephone a housekeeper. I like that. Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Speaking of family, speaking of how we relate to each other, the next three chapters are actually revolving around what I would call the gray areas of life. Is it right? Is it wrong? Is it okay? You know, it's a hot summer day, and you crack open a few beers. Is that okay? You go to a movie with your friends or your wife or your husband, and you see an R-rated movie. Is that okay? There's a question that a lot of people ask about everything that they do. Is this okay? They don't ask, is it right or is it wrong, but is it okay? And when you ask the question, think about what you're asking. Is it okay? It's almost as if, what can I do or what can I get away with and still be counted as a Christian? What can I get away with and still be saved? Is it okay? Well, it misses the whole point here because people love religion where you can codify every aspect of behavior. Oh, this is wrong, this is right, this is wrong, and put it all in a list. But when it comes to the things of God, he does not codify all the behavior. What he does, there are things certainly that are clearly wrong. There are certain sins that are clearly sin. There are other things that are not so clear. It's gray. And in the gray areas, how do you respond? What do you do? Well, thankfully, we get to take a glimpse at a dilemma the Corinthian church faced. In its culture, in its time, something that would not even have any meaning to us at all, yet it has an amazing application for us. Because the question you end up asking is, when you come here, are you thinking in terms of this is family, or are you coming to an organization? See, this is an organization, then there's an element that you're going to miss. If you don't care what people think about you, then perhaps you've misunderstood what Christianity is all about. There is an aspect now where there's a genuine concern for others. In fact, that is, folks, the greatest evangelistic outreach we can have. Jesus said it, by your love for one another shall they know that you're mine. Shall people know, hey, there's a God working among these people. There's something real here by that love that they see. So the situation there, Paul writes, 1 Corinthians 8, now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world and that there is no other God but one. But even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on the earth, as there are great many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge, for some with consciousness of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. You couldn't go to the grocery store in Corinth without having a dilemma, to be perhaps aware of the meat that you were buying in the marketplace. What was this meat, you know, like a bargain sale meat that came through the pagan sacrifices? You know, in the pagan sacrifices, you'd bring your meat. You'd bring your sacrifice. And then what you do, you would get your portion of it. The priests would get their portion of it. And then there would be another portion that would be burned up on the altar for your God. Well, generally, there were so many of these sacrifices. Of course, the priests didn't eat all of it, so they would take it to the marketplace and they would sell it. And then the meat would be intermingled with all the other meat in the marketplace. So now you as a believer are going there and wondering. You buy this and it's got the label Grand Demon on it. And you, well, you know, what are demons? You know, you as a Christian, you've been a Christian for some time. You know that all of those gods are false gods anyway. They're all idols. And the very word idol in the Hebrew means nothing. They're big nothings. All the pagan gods that people fear, they're nothings. They're big nothings. So there's nothing to worry about. So you bring the meat home, you got a great deal at the demon market, and you know, bring it home and you're serving it up for your guests, and one of your guests notices the demon label and wonders, "What are you serving? I used to go to that temple. I've got demons in me right now." Now, of course, we don't have that situation here. But there was an uneasiness of conscience that we can relate to in other areas. See, there are many tender believers in Corinth wondering if the meat that they purchased was meat that was offered up to pagans, to the pagan sacrifices. Were there demonic entities attached to it? Does buying this meat constitute a compromise? Is it idol worship? Is it a danger to me spiritually? You know, we'd go out into various areas of L.A., doing street evangelism, and we would notice the Hare Krishnas were out there, and from time to time they put on these huge vegetarian feasts. And everyone could come and eat freely. But their belief was if you ate of their food that they had chanted over and prayed over, that their gods would come in you and would convince you that, you know, being a Hare Krishna was the right way to go. So naturally they put all this food out, and a lot of the homeless people come in and chow down, and they got a few recruits here and there from that. But of course, Paul says, you know, we see here that there are so-called gods, whether in heaven and earth, but for us, there's really only one God. If you have this knowledge, you know, that has no effect. You don't have to worry about that. See, now there's a strong debate in the church over a lot of these other areas. This was a gray area. There was nothing really clear-cut about this, because what Paul is encouraging, will encourage the believers to do, is to let another principle guide them in regard to buying other than just pure knowledge. Pure knowledge says, no problem. No demons, can't touch me, I'm a believer, got a good deal at that demon market. I'm not going to worry about it. But that knowledge was not enough to make a full decision, and that's what he's going to say. See, there's a lot of gray areas in Christians' lives. Lots of things that we're free. In fact, it was for freedom that Christ set us free. He set us free from the bondage of the law. He set us free from our sin. We've got a new heart and a new life. But you see, here's the thing. There's these areas of our lives that could possibly stumble others. You might be a mature believer and watching television programs. Not a problem. Yes, it's wrong to view pornography, but what about this reality show and it's a little bit of sexual innuendo and there's a little bit of violence in it, or there's a little bit of this. I mean, it's just a gray area. It doesn't bother you. It doesn't affect you. So you watch it. Social drinking. Yes, it's wrong to drink too much, clearly, and get drunk. But what about a glass of wine with a meal? What about a few beers, an occasional martini? Christians vary greatly on this subject, and what is no trouble to some is a great stumbling block to others. Others could have a beer and stop. Others couldn't stop at one. Others couldn't think of having one because it supports an industry that is inherently destroying so many lives. So they think in terms of conscience sake. Now what about Mickey Mouse? No, Pastor, not Mickey. Please. Not Disney's Mickey. What are you talking about here? Well, to some, Disney and its companies stumble many sincere believers because of what they support, the advertisers that they use. That to boycott Disney is a lifelong goal for some. And they can't imagine Christians would actually support that industry. For some are scandalized, some are like, come on, get over yourself. See, there's a variety of things. What about driving? Obeying the speed limit. Now this gets close to home for me. By the way, my reputation is much worse than it really is in reality, although some would argue with that, I'm sure. You know, I was convicted a number of years ago because I just, you know, it was one of those freedoms that didn't bother me. And I can see the traffic patterns, and I wouldn't like to impede anybody, but if I see an opening, I'm going to go for it. And others are scandalized. It looks like he's cutting that person off. Well, I got behind somebody on the way to church one time. And those of you who know this, if you've been here for a few years, you remember this. But I was a little frustrated how slow this person was going, especially when they get off the exit. Okay, now I'm behind them and you're putting along. And they get up to the intersection and I'm waiting to see. And I can see there's no cars coming. Hello, turn left already. So I'm talking to myself. And I'm on my way to church, right, to teach and be all spiritual and that sort of thing. So finally, you know, the car comes and it's wide open. They still aren't going. They're like looking in the car way down there. They might be close. So I honk, honk, no response. Another couple of openings come by and go. And then I honk, honk. And then finally, when it was dangerous, they dart out. I'm like... So I come out behind him and I come up on the side and I'm giving him the old, like, look. And it was the wife of one of our pastors here. So I saw her and I was like, oops. So I had to apologize. I get up in the pulpit and I say, you know, I have to make an apology to so-and-so. I'm not going to mention any names. I honked behind her, you know, several times. And I'm confessing this. But you could have went, I said, you know. You know, it's one of those areas where there's a liberty, and yet in the liberty, there's another consideration. There's another consideration. It's others. So it is in so many areas, whether it be music, whether it be dress. See, certain areas of liberty, people on one side will say, well, how can I be limited? I'm free. You know, I don't have a problem in that area. And this is typically true for, let's say, women in the summertime. You know, young girls that are dressed very provocatively, and they're, you know, I mean, I don't want to assign any moral blame to them, but they really are clueless as to how that might affect a man. And to them, they're free. You know, it's hot, I'm going to dress, you know, skimpy, and the clothing styles are becoming more and more provocative, and I don't want to look like a nerd out there, so I'm just going to conform to the rest of my generation. And but they don't think of the necessary ingredient that Paul is going to express here, and that is others. There's a limit to our freedom, is what I'm saying. We are free, but there's a limit. Now, the limit is not decided on by any standard, by any law, by any constraint, other than what Paul is going to show us is love. He says it right here. Concerning things offered to idols, we know that we have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up. It's like he's saying, he's complimenting. We know we're smart. We've been there. We know there are no demons that can get inside us from the food. But knowledge alone puffs up. You know, it makes you conceited. Superior knowledge and intelligence often leads to conceit. Truth without love is brutality. Love without truth is hypocrisy. There's a dilemma on both sides, and there's a balance here. The Corinthians weren't the only ones that had this issue. Paul, the apostle, had another situation that took place. In Acts 15, there was a dilemma in the early church. The Jewish believers wouldn't even go eat with the Gentile believers because they were afraid of where that meat came from. They were afraid that it wasn't kosher, that it wasn't proper for them to eat. And so the balance came back from the church that basically said, you know, the Gentiles were encouraged to avoid fornication, things, you know, strangled. That is, instead of having it properly bled as meat, it was strangled. And the main reason, I believe, was because it fostered fellowship. That was the whole point of it. Avoid that so that you can fellowship with others. So in this case, a believer was so fully convinced an idol didn't really exist, he partook of this feast from this demon meat, not thinking it was a big deal. And this knowledge to him was very freeing. Oh, not a problem. But there is a problem. It led to someone else being bothered, being stumbled by it. There is not in everyone that knowledge, verse 7. For some with a consciousness of the idol until now eats it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. This is not as unusual as you think. Old chains are certainly broken when you become a Christian, but old habits die hard. You know that. You know, it's easy to relapse into darker moments. And you know, how dangerous it would be for a man who had been on drugs or alcohol to think now that he's a Christian that it should never pose a temptation for him anymore. And he would put himself in danger's way. A young believer could relapse in a moment, while a mature believer may not even flinch at the temptation. You know, I can fully realize that, you know, as a Christian, to give in to baser urges of sexual desire is wrong. I know that, you know, the end result in my mind, I see the illusion out there. It's a lie. It's much more fulfilling to be content with my wife. The temptation is still out there, though. And even though I know the right path, I could easily be swayed by my emotions. Hanging around a temptation because I think I understand how bad it is, I'd never go down that road. That'd be foolish. In fact, many, many people fall into sin because they think, oh, I would never do that. I'd never do that. Knowledge puffs up. Some would say, okay, Pastor, to me, this whole issue is an issue of freedom, and I think that it should go the other way. I think that those without the knowledge need to be instructed. It's their problem. It's not my problem. I can't even tell you how many times people come in for marriage counseling and it's her problem, that's why I'm here. Or it's his problem, that's why I'm here. None of them have the conception that I remember one time just facing off with this big, burly, macho guy, you know, and he was in because his wife was struggling with a relationship that he had with his daughter and as a, you know, from another marriage, and you know, it seemed like he was giving her all the attention and she was struggling with this. And so in his mind, all right, I'll go to counseling. I'll hear, you know, it's you got a problem here. I don't have a problem here. It's your problem. So he said that. He says, I don't have a problem here. It's her problem. And I jumped all over his face. I said, her problem is your problem. And I just jumped on him. Of course, 2 weeks later, he said he wanted to kill me. But he said that he hadn't been talked like that since he was in junior high. And yet God dealt with him. And he realized it. Something went off. It clicked. It is my problem if it's her problem. See, this is the thing now. With people who say, well, it's their issue, it's not mine. Wrong. You are part of a family. You're part of the body of Christ. So now your consideration has to be beyond this. Now, I know that many would love for us to have a set of rules. It makes it easy, doesn't it? Okay, now these are the rules to be a member here at Calvary Chapel. You meet these rules, you can be a member. If not, you know, sayonara. You can't be a member. Be easy for us to do that, but you know, where would the self-control, which is the fruit of the Spirit, be allowed to multiply itself in our life? Where would we learn the fruits of the Spirit, of patience and love? This is where we learn it when we think in terms of others. In fact, you know the old acronym, JOY, J-O-Y, Jesus, others, yourself. There's your balance. Putting Jesus first, then others, then yourself. There's where you're going to have true joy. So does mere knowledge guide you or love? That's the question. So he says, not everyone has knowledge. A young believer could stumble in a moment. So what should be our attitude? Verse 8, notice. He says, but food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat it are we the better, nor if we don't eat it are we the worse. It's not in the abstaining from the food that helps in itself. You know, suppose a Christian does not see total abstinence from intoxicants to be obligatory for him. He doesn't see the problem. I can have a beer, I can have a drink, no problem. So he partakes moderately, but he's not conscious, he's not aware of others around him who more recently have escaped the snares of alcohol and encouraging by his example others that they might stumble. They might think, well, oh, I guess it's okay if you have one. And maybe I can do that now. I'm a Christian. And so he gets back into it and those old feelings come up and he stumbled completely. See, people with liberty often complain. This is their big complaint. They hate limiting their liberties because of others' weaknesses. The world certainly doesn't understand this. I remember years ago when I was out in California, my brother-in-law had asked me, I was on my way to the store to get some things. He says, "Hey, bring a couple six-packs back, you know, Bud." And I said, I really am not going to do that. He goes, "Why?" I go, "Well, if I'm buying a couple of six-packs, and there's somebody that knows me, and I'm a pastor, and they're seeing me buy a couple of six-packs, they're not going to wonder, well, is he getting it for somebody else? I mean, it might stumble them. They might look at me and go, well, wow, I guess it's okay, you know, and maybe it'll be okay for me." And then they could stumble. All he could consider was, I was worried what other people were thinking, and I was in bondage to worry about what other people are going to think about my life. And he saw that as a prison, but he did not see that my motivation was not because I'm afraid of what people are going to think of me, but rather, I might stumble somebody. Because that very real thing happened to me when I'd first gotten saved. I never had a problem with alcohol, and I became a Christian, and I was in the bar with some of my friends. After I become a Christian, I'm telling them about the Lord. And I saw another friend over, and I walked over, had a beer in my hand. "Hey, how you doing? You know, hey, I became a Christian," and I'm witnessing, right? Well, they looked at me like, "Well, why are you drinking? Why are you here?" I'm like, "Oh, well, this is just a beer. I'm not getting drunk or anything." "Yeah, okay, sure." And at that point, I couldn't explain it. I felt very uncomfortable that now I had ruined an opportunity to reach that person. And then I looked at the beer and I go, "Do I really need this?" All of a sudden it dawned on me, it's not the food. It's not the abstaining from the food that matters. It's not, "Ooh, look at me, I'm a teetotaler completely. Look how spiritual I am, I've given it all up." It has nothing to do with it. Because you're free. And I know there are many that, you know, in the privacy of their homes, and, you know, they'll have a beer or they'll have a glass of wine, and you know what? That's between them and God. But here, you've got to be aware. For example, if you're going to the store, now you've got to be a little careful because, of course, you know, if I were to pick up that six-pack up for my brother-in-law and it's in my shopping cart and I'm checking out and I'm putting it up on the counter and someone's, "Hey, Loy, what are you doing?" No, it's for my brother-in-law, you know. I find myself having to walk weird. You know, like, look, I'm really not, and I'm instead of just being free, I'm now in bondage. And you can be sure if I see you in Sam's Club or in the grocery store, I'm going to go through your shopping cart. I'm going to, what do you got in there? I'm going to just peek and look. Oh, what's the, ooh. It's for cooking, Pastor. It's cooking wine, see? Oh, okay, all right. But you know what? The point is, we can have fun with this in a way, but what's really the issue here? The motivation is that love condescends. It goes down in the valley. See, this happens in a number of other areas with people. Let's take worship, for example. I know that certain, you know, Pentecostal groups, they'll come among us and they'll feel, well, you guys just haven't quite got there yet. You know, you're coming along, you're getting a little bit. I see people raising their hands, but you know, you really got to begin to dance in the Spirit. You've really got to be free. And David danced, and you know, they begin to go in that road. But what they're not realizing is as they're going up in the mountains to worship the Lord, they fail to realize that most people are down in the valleys, no consciousness of the things of God. And they come to church, and if they see all of you just going wild with exuberance in a way that is almost to them a little bit flamboyant and weird, and you people are a little strange, you ruin an opportunity to reach them. People often wonder, well, why do we do things here at Calvary the way we do it? I love the fact that we can worship freely. Hey, if you want to stand, you can stand and worship. If you want to raise your hands, you're free to do that. But you know, sometimes when people go and they don't know where to stop, and they'll go to the next level. And then pretty soon what happens is instead of people thinking about Jesus, they're thinking, what's that knucklehead doing over there? And now their attention is on that person rather than on the Lord. So you unwittingly, even though in your heart you're thinking, well, I'm going to teach these people how to worship, you really are just drawing attention to yourself. And instead of them worshiping the Lord, they're wondering, what are you doing? You know, if I go to a church, I'm always conscious of how that particular fellowship is. And I'm not going to do anything out of the ordinary there. I would respect that, because I certainly wouldn't want to bring attention to me. You know, likewise, the same thing here. It's just a matter of condescending. You know, when we go to a third world country, I do a lot of traveling in third world countries, and I've discovered that it's very important that we're careful of how we flash around money, even a little bit of money that we're buying a souvenir. They're looking on and they're going, he just spent a month's worth of money on that little trinket. And they're scandalized by that. We encourage people going to third world countries. You know, if you're bringing pictures of your family, just make sure if you're showing them that it doesn't have your house or your car behind it, all the things you own, because it blows their mind. They can't conceive of that. And it stumbles them as they see just people spending so much for some little thing. And so we're very careful in that. We're sensitive. In other words, we're limiting a freedom we have in the Lord to because of conscience sake, because of loving them. And that's what love does. Love lays its life down for a friend. You deny what you'd want to do for the sake of others. That's a family. You know, you got four people in a family and they all want to go to a different place and vacation. They all want to have a different agenda, a different idea. How do you unify that? Well, there obviously on this juncture, some have to defer to the wishes of the greater group. And so you defer your rights. Oh, but Pastor, this just sounds so narrow to me. You know, why are you so fussy about that stuff? You know, a very real circumstance hit me when my daughter was about 7. You know, one of the guys in the church, you know, were able to get us these great deals on the alcohol-free beer. And I liked the taste of it. I never really struggled with alcohol, but I didn't want to put a stumbling block. So I thought, well, you know, we'll get some alcohol-free beer. So I found myself drinking the alcohol-free beer, but then a couple of things I noticed myself doing that pointed out to me, why am I doing this? First of all, when I put it in the trash can, I was conscious of covering it so no one would see it. Because I didn't want them to think that, you know, they're not going to get the label on and go, oh yeah, there's no alcohol, okay, that's all right, Pastor. I didn't want them to think that. But then I was worried, why am I even doing this? Do I even need it that much? But what really hit me, I was sitting around the table, and I poured a glass, and my daughter, 7 years old, she says, Daddy, I don't think you should be drinking that stuff. I'm like, where did she get that? I says, honey, this is not like real beer. It's like near beer. It's just, look, it's no alcohol in it. Well, I still think it's wrong. Well, you know what? That broke my heart to hear her say that. And I says, you know what, honey? You're right. And I threw the stuff away, and I never got any more. Not because, for any other reason, that I loved her and I didn't want to put a stumbling block in her way. And that's really what Paul is driving at here. Notice what he says. He says, but beware, verse 9, lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. Now, in your mind, you say, well, if they're weak, then get with the program. Get strong. What's the matter with you? You know, realize this is nothing. It's no big deal. You're free. You don't have to worry about it. Well, there are a lot of weak people in that. But the weakness actually is inherent in all of us in some areas. See, some might be weak with alcohol and not have any problems with movies. Others might stumble over movies and have no problem with alcohol. The funny thing is, even when you became a Christian, did you notice that some things the Lord took away from you immediately wasn't even an issue anymore? Other things you struggled, like giving it over to him, and you know, you stumbled and you kept bringing it back and asking God for forgiveness, and you'd stumble again. And someone else had no problem with that immediately, but they were still struggling with the thing you gave up immediately. So you get the two of them together and, hey, what's the matter with you? Why are you struggling with this? Lord took that away from me immediately. But on the other side, you're struggling with what God took away from them immediately. We all have some area. And so here's where how the body works the best. It's out of consideration for others. You know, the true freedom I've learned is learning what I don't need to have. I don't need to have, you know, that taste of beer. I don't need to see that movie, even though I'll go on screenit.com before I even go see a movie. Because I've been surprised in the past about what you think is a safe movie to see. And even at the recommendations of Christians, oh, it's a great movie. And you go there and you go, okay, I don't need to see this stuff. You know, it's a little over the top. Maybe some people don't even, they're not even conscious of hearing all the language. and they recommend a movie based on the plot. Others recommend a movie and they don't see the sexuality in it. Others might be stumbled with it. And you know, the funny thing is, it's like we all have a different area that God is dealing with us about. For me, the true freedom has been just not needing to go down those roads at all. I'm free without it. Others would say, well, that's confining. You're in bondage. Well, it's not in bondage at all if love is your motivation. I delight in it. I don't think about, oh, I can't do this, you know, because of what it might look for someone. I don't moan over that. I'm free to not have to go down that road. So here, you got to beware. The weak and the strong. Now, I can tell you as a young believer, I was very weak in a number of areas. More in the area of some of my books. When I became a Christian, I had always been very susceptible to, you know, certain things that lofted itself against God. Sorcery books. I had a collection of Khalil Gibran's books. And, you know, some of these Eastern mystics and, you know, the sorcery types of things. I was just curious about that stuff before. But when I became a Christian, man, it felt like there was demons attached to this stuff. I immediately just threw it all in the incinerator at college. I remember taking the load of it. And now to a more mature brother, they might have said, hey, what are you doing, man? Those are some collector's items. And I'd love to research that. I don't have a problem in that area. But for me, I couldn't even have it around. It was too big of a stumbling block for me. Ephesians. Remember the Ephesians when they came to the Lord and they had all these idols to Diana and all these sorcery books. And they all came and they brought them and they burned them. Now, people hear that and they go, book burning. Oh, my. Is that what Christians do? No, there's a big difference between you willingly saying, I'm getting this junk out of my life, and some regime forcing you to burn things that they don't feel is appropriate. Totally different. There might be some things you need to incinerate in your homes if you really think about it. If it's stumbling you, or if it could stumble someone else. Now, movies, for example, as a young believer, I couldn't handle any of the sexual content in movies. And I remember going to a movie, not even realizing it was R, with my friends. And the violence and the nudity, I had nightmares that night. I'm just a young believer. And I was totally scandalized by it. And of course, they weren't even, oh, there was nudity in it? Oh, yeah, I guess there was. They weren't even aware of it. And it all came back to the fact that sometimes we look at this freedom we have. What are we going to do with that? Now, it is for freedom that Christ set us free. We are free. We are free in Christ. We don't want to go back to the shadow lands of the law. Do not taste, do not touch, do not handle. You know, and some people get into this. Churches tend toward legalism, and they carefully outline all of the rules of the church. Not going to happen here. How you dress, what movies you go to, what you drink, frankly, is going to be in the court of your choice. And if you choose to partake in that, then I would say to you, be careful that you don't put a stumbling block in front of somebody else. But I believe that it's wiser to learn how to be free from those things that you think you're free to partake. Because there's a freedom from and not just a freedom to. So the two extremes, you got to be careful. License on the one hand, which basically says you can justify anything from loose business practices to loose sexual practices. And then legalism, which everything is classified and scruples and lists are a mile long. Let's take a look at some principles here. He says, verse 10, if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat some of those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? In other words, he's aware that the demons in that meat are now coming in him. And he's defiled by that. In his mind, he's totally sinned against God. And he could stumble completely and walk away from God thinking he's totally turned his back on Jesus. He says, so when you sin, thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. You know, that's one of the principles that you've got to understand that it's so important to comprehend. Is that Jesus says, if you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. How you are toward even those little believers, those baby believers, is you're treating Christ. And if you're insensitive to them and where they are, or not conscious of who you're around and what you're doing, you can really stumble them and wound their conscience. And thus doing so, that which you're free and is not a sin in itself, guess what? It becomes a sin. Because now it's not in love that you're doing it. So look at his conclusion in verse 13. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Paul just says, I'm free to not eat meat if it causes my brother to stumble. If I have to go to the marketplace and there's no way I can tell whether the meat is there and someone's wondering where I got the meat and I can't give an honest, it's like, hey, you know what? I'll be a vegetarian then because I love people that much. And I think that's the point that he wants to make. There's a few things that I think are good principles. He's going to uncover more in the next few chapters, some other aspects that will really be kind of challenging about learning how to deny yourself and some Old Testament examples, and of course some of the real danger points that Corinthians had to face. But let's take a look at some other principles for these gray areas in closing. Number one, I think it's a good question, is ask yourself, is the activity in question that important? Isn't that important? Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 says, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let's lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily besets us and run with patience the race that is set before us. Let's just be freed from any encumbrance. If it's any question, it's an encumbrance. Secondly, is the activity profitable? Is it helpful for you? You know, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, we noted this. He says, all things are lawful to me, but not all things profit. All things are lawful as a believer, but I won't be brought under the power of any. So there's two things. Is it really helpful for me? Is it going to bring me under its power? 1 Corinthians, you know, it's like television, for example. You know, you're free. What happens is after a while, you find yourself watching 2 and 3 hours a night, and now you're under the power of it. And now you've got into such a habit, it's almost an addiction. You come home from work and you can't think of not turning it on. It just goes on and you just vegetate for 3 hours. Well, you know what? That's not very helpful. So maybe that's something you're free to do, but maybe it's something you need to reevaluate. Is it helpful? Is it profitable? Thirdly, 1 John 2, verse 6. In fact, I want you to turn there because that's a real challenging one. It's actually the subject of the little bracelets that you wear. What would Jesus do? Notice 1 John 2, verse 6. He says, he who says he abides in him ought himself to walk just as he walked. So one thing always about Jesus is that no one could ever find any reproach in him. They could, even his enemies scrutinized, trying to find something to pin on him, and they couldn't. Imagine having a life like that. That's just above reproach. No one can point the finger at you about anything because you're walking as Jesus would walk. Next, is it something that would bring a reproach? Will it stumble someone that is outside the faith? Will it cause them to go, Christians, you know, they're all hypocrites. If it's something that would cause them to keep away from Jesus, Bible says in Colossians 4, 5, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time for the days are evil, making most of the opportunities that you have. Because people are watching you, and you're a letter. You're read of all men. You don't even know. People are reading your life. You've mentioned you're a Christian. Now they're watching you with an eagle eye. You know, if your heart is set to want to walk like Jesus walked, you'll be an example. Then next is, will it edify? Will it build you up? Is it something that is edifying? 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23. Again, all things are lawful, but not all things profit. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Not all things will actually do something in you to encourage you. One is, yeah, you don't want to be brought under the power, but this one is it really helping you? Is it helping your discipleship? Is it developing you? But the final real test, I think, of everything we do is 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 11. And this encompasses just about everything that we can apply to. And You know, I ask the Lord all the time that I want this to be a part of my life. He says in 4:11, he says, if anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. When I get up here, I don't want to have my own words and thoughts and opinions and ideas. I want to convey what the Scriptures say. He says, if anyone ministers, let him do it with the ability which God supplies. So if I serve him, I want to serve him in his strength. And of course, he says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. So I've discovered when I'm in him and I'm doing it in his strength, it's a joy. It's an overflow. There is no bummerness to it. It's a great thing. And then he says that all things, and this is the whole goal for our lives, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. And that is the goal. Will it glorify God? So whether you eat or drink, he'll say later in 1 Corinthians 10, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. If you can do it to his glory, if it glorifies him, if it brings him glory, and of course the fruit of the Spirit does, when you walk in that love and that joy and that peace and that patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, that gives God glory. And that's true freedom. Having the ability to do the right thing, that's true freedom. Not just doing what you want, because you could easily get into bondage that way, but doing what he's called you to do. You know, practically, no rules. Paul had Timothy circumcised, but later refused to circumcise Titus. Both reasoned out that it would be the appropriate thing at the time. He didn't want to stumble the Jewish people for Timothy, and at the same time, he saw that if he circumcised Titus, it would send a wrong message to the Gentiles that, you know, that was important. So there was no rule. It was he did things in accordance to what was going to be best for the people and setting the example, because circumcision or uncircumcision really is nothing. Food or not food, or drink or not drink, that's not the issue. It's really all about love. One of the biggest stumbling blocks in the area of churches oftentimes is money. And, you know, in that case, I've had a great example set for me by Chuck Smith, who, you know, God blessed him immensely in ministry. He inherited a lot from his family, but he lives very simply. He doesn't live extravagantly. He's used even a lot of his personal money and wealth that he'd accumulated from his family, pouring it into ministry. Still wears those, don't get mad, Chuck, if you hear this, those cheap Sears suits. And he still just, you know, drives around in this old car, and not extravagantly old. It's a nice car, but it's like 5 or 6 years old. It's not the latest, greatest, fancy model. And I look at him and I go, you know what, that's the model. And he understands that one of the stumbling blocks for people oftentimes in ministry is they associate the church. They just want your money. That's all it is. It's a big scam. So he doesn't want to put a stumbling block in front of anybody. He's had friends that have given him Rolex watches. He says he just has to give them away because, you know, if he wears a Rolex, it would bother them. It would stumble them. Someone maybe just struggling to get by, they see their pastor in a Rolex. Unfortunately, this is not the example that's often set and that people think of when they think of pastors and churches, where you hear these extravagant, you know, ministries spending immense amount of money and salaries that are ridiculous. And you know what? Can't do it if we're going to really effectively be an example and model the believer. So in every respect, this is the thought. Now, again, am I free? Am I free to, you know, partake? I mean, later he's going to talk about this issue in regard to even receiving a salary, but he's going to understand that there's a greater picture, there's a greater thing at stake here, and that is love. It always guided what Paul did, certainly guided what Jesus did. I mean, all the families he could have chosen to be born in, God could have sent him to be born into a very well-off family and born in a nice hospital and sanitary conditions. And look at how Jesus came so that he could identify with us. It's love. It's thinking of others first. God, or in this case, Jesus, others, you. There's your secret for joy.